Okay, we're beginning here by the two dots on the bottom of Samach Bet Amud Bet. Amar Rabba, Palgo de Itli Be'ara, Palgo. Palgo Be'ara de Itli, Riva. This is the scenario in which there are two individuals who are partners in a piece of property. Reuben and Shimon are partners in this property. Reuben owns half the property. Shimon owns the other half of the property. Then Reuben goes ahead and sells his portion of the partnership. And expressing the sale of his partnership, he does one of the two following languages. He either says, Paga de Itli Bara, my half of the land I am selling to you. In that case, Paga, he sold the full half. He sold everything that he owned because he's basically saying, I'm selling you my half of the partnership. On the other hand, if he uses the language of Paga Bara de Itli, I'm selling you half of the land that I have, then he's really giving him Revia, a quarter of the totality. Because when he says it in that way or expresses it in that way, he's not saying I'm selling you my half of the partnership. I'm selling you 50% of my half of the partnership. Because he's saying I'm selling you a half of the land that I have. What land I have is only 50% of it. So that means that you're only getting a quarter of the land. Amarle Abaye, Abaye says to Rabbo, his Rebbe, Maishno Hochi, Maishno Hochi. Why does the language make a difference? In either case, the way that the Abaye is expressing it over here is, just like Palga Ditli Be'ara means a half, so too Palga Dara Ditli means a half. Because it just says, I'm selling you a half, which is the land that I own. So you can interpret it in that way as well, which is not I'm selling you a half of the land I own. I'm selling you the half, which is the land that I own in the partnership. You could explain it that way. And then you could have either one be interpreted to mean that he's selling him the entire 50% of the land, meaning the part of the ownership, the part of the partnership that he owns. Ishtik, Rabba did not respond to Abaye. Amar Abaye, Abaye therefore concluded, Ana Savre midi Ishtik, Kabule Kablo, that I assumed that since Rabba was silent to my question, that he acquiesced to my question. In the end, there's no difference between the languages and you get a half. But it says, Velohi, that's not the case. Chazina Anu Shtare Denafke mi Bei Mar. We see these shtarot that are coming out of the Beit Din of Mar. Mar here means the Rebbe of Abaye, which means Rabba. Out of Rabba's Beit Din, Mekhtibu. And written in those shtarot are hachi. Palga itli ba'ara, palga. If he says, palga itli ba'ara, palga. Palga ba'ara itli, riva. So the way that the Rashbam explains it is that at the top of the contract, this language was there. At the bottom of the contract where they give more detail as to what happened, there in the bottom of the contract in cases where it says, palga itli ba'ara, there at the bottom it said that he bought the full 50% of the property, or I mean the entire portion of the partnership that this individual owned. But on the other hand, when it had a language of Palga Ba'ara Di'idli, if that was the language at the top of the contract, at the bottom of the contract, it said that he only got a riva. He got a quarter of the total field, or 50% of the 50% that this person owns in the partnership. That's the way the Rashbam explains it, that there was this general statement up top and details of it down below. The details down below show you that Rabba maintained that distinction that he had in the language and did not acquiesce to Abaye. Now then, the Balei Tosafot say, Klomar Hayumi Gavin, that when that language was found, that the Beit Din of Rabba, when they had this language, would give them 50%, and when they had that language, gave them a quarter. So not that it was written in the contract and explained the contract, but rather, contracts with this phrase in it, they concluded and gave them 50%. Contracts with this language only gave them 25%. So you see that Rabba maintained that distinction that he had made to Abaye before. Ve'amar Rabba. Rabba also brings another din here, which is a distinction in language. Meitzara de mina pligo. If it is from the land that we are dividing, palga, it's half. Meitzara de mina psika. If the border of the land is from that which we separated out, tet kabin, you get 9 kav, which we saw earlier in the Gemara that tet kabim is the minimum shiur, a standard for something to be called a sadeh. So here, Rabba draws a distinction in the languages, where a person is demarcating the borders of a property. We're now reading it like the Rashbam. We'll come back in a second and see that the Rabbeinu Gershom reads this differently. The way that the Rashbam reads it is that the person is demarcating borders. He gives 3 borders. That's Reuben on the north, you have Shimon on the east, you have Levi in the south, and then on the western side, that's the property that we are splitting. And he gives a dividing line, or the 4th border, to be the property that we are splitting. So that's what the Gemara says. If he demarcates the 4th border by saying that the 4th border is the land that we are splitting, then that's exactly what he bought. He bought half the property. That means that he gave him the north, eastern, and southern borders. The western border is going to be half of the property. And that's what he's saying. That your fourth border is the half of the property that you bought. That means that the residual half belongs to me, that he didn't sell it. On the other hand, if he says to him that the fourth border is the property from which I carved out a piece, then all he sold him was a strip of land that was tet kabin. Because then he's saying that I'm apportioning a piece that I took off of my property. So the portioning, the piece that came off of my property, means that I maintain the residual of the property myself, and I only cut off a slice for you, that slice that I cut off, which is the minimum shiur for sadeh, is tet kabin. And that's all you get. You don't get half of the property in that case. Gemara says, Amar Abaye, Maishna Ochi, Maishna Ochi. Why does the language make any difference over here? Both of them can be explained that whether you say palga or pliga, or whether you say chelek, both of them can mean to split in half. Ishtik, Rabba was silent. Silver mina idavide palga. Again, Abaye concluded from Rabba's silence that was acquiescence, and therefore both of them mean to split it in half. Velohi, and that's not the case. Davar Rav Yemer bar Shlomayo, the Dedim Afarsheli mini de Abaye. I had this issue of Abaye explained to me. Ben Meitzar Ara Dimina Palga. Ben Meitzar Ara Dimina Psika. Doesn't matter which language that you use from Rabba. If he adds in this language, Elaine Matsrahana, that these are the borders, meaning that in addition to delineating the borders, he uses this extraneous language called Elaine Matsranaha, that these are the borders of the property, that extraneous language that we're going to see all along, we Iter Lashon, the extraneous language gives him more rights. Those more rights are that he gets half of the property. Lo Amarle Elaine Matsranaha. If you don't add in that extraneous language, Tisha Kabin, then you only get the minimum amount, which is the 9 Kav. That's all the amount of the field you get. So in the first, we thought when Abaye again questioned Rabba, and Rabba was silent, that that silence was acquiescence. And therefore, the conclusion would mean that we're indifferent between these languages. And no matter which language you use, you would get half. What Rav Yemar bar Shalmaya comes to explain to us is that's not the case. That when Abaye says there's no difference in the language, no difference means the following. That if there's no difference between the languages and there's nothing extraneous in the contract, all you're going to get is tet kabin. The other hand, if there's extraneous language in the contract, which then gains you more rights, then either of these languages will result in you getting half the field. That is the way that the Rashbam explains it. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom says that this case here is similar to the case before of Rabba. It's in a case where you have partners. Reuven and Shimon are partners in the land, and each one of them has 50% of the land. And when he delineates or demarcates the borders, he gives the three borders around, and on the fourth side, he gives the border as being the point at which he split the land with his partner. He had 50%, Reuven has 50% of it, Shimon has 50% of it. Reuven delineates the north, east, and southern borders as being properties surrounding it. And then on the western side, he says, on the western side, the border is the 50% point where I split with my partner. In that case, Vadai, he sold the whole palga. He sold the entire 50% of his ownership. He sold the whole field to this individual. On the other hand, if he says that the border on that western side, which abuts his partner's property, he says the following. Meitzar lo meitzar echad b'hai lishna, the ruach ploni ara d'mina psika, that land from which was separated out or segregated out a piece, then lo kana ba lokeach elasadesh shel tet kabin. Then the buyer only gets 9 kav in there. So if the fourth border is delineated in the following manner, which is that he says that the fourth border is the land that I split with my partner, then that's the dividing line. And that means he granted him the entire 50% he owns in this property. On the other hand, if he uses that western border and says that that western border is along the land from which I've given you a portion, then all you've gotten is a portion. And that means that you get tet kabin, you get the sadev tet kabin, and the remainder will stay with the mocher. Then Abaye challenges that and says, what's the difference between the language? And then we have Rabbi Yemer bar Shalmaya coming along and saying, Ila Matsrahana. And this is the way that the Reino Gershom explains it. I amarle v'ilan Matsrahana. If he says these are the boundaries, Upershan the Mizrach Meitzar Ploni, the Marab Meitzar Ploni, Vichen Kulam. If he gives all the boundaries, these are the boundaries around it, then you get everything that's inside of the boundaries. Aval, the Heichad lo perish lo mitzranim, if he does not give the enumeration of the borders, velo perish lan shar mitzranim lo kanal tet kabim shir sadeh lachut, then he only gets a amount of 9 kav. So if he just says, the land from which I am dividing out a piece, or the land from which I am taking off a piece, then all you're getting is a piece of that land, and that is this sadeh, that is tet kabim. So therefore, the Rabbeinu Gershom means, ila matzrahana, literally, did he put in the borders, or did he not put in the borders? If he put in the borders, doesn't matter how he expresses it, he gets the entirety of your portion of the partnership. If you do not put the borders in, then no matter what language you use about what you sold to him, he will only get a portion of the field. That minimum portion is tet kabin of the field. And that's the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom reads it. Pshita, it's pretty clear. Amar yechlok ploni b'nechsai, a person should split my possessions. Palga, that we know means half. Because yechlok or lachlok means to split, to divide. And without any other information, we would assume that it means to divide in half, 50-50, and therefore you would get half of whatever is there in terms of his possessions. And obviously in this case, when it says, Yachlok plone b'nechsai, it's clearly an identifiable other parties here, whether it means me and him are going to split it, he's going to split it with my child, or he's going to split it with my children. Since there are clearly a defined numbers of parties that are here, that split will be based on the number of parties that are splitting. If there are two, it's 50%. If there are three, it'll be 33 1/3%. If there are four, it'll be 25%, because lachlok means you get an equal right to all the other claimants that have a right to collect over here. Tznu chelek deploni b'nechsai. He says, give a portion of my possessions to so-and-so. My, what's the din there? When he says a portion, does he literally mean a portion, or does he mean chelek from the word lachlok, to split? So does he mean 50%, or does he mean some other percentage based on what this chelek is? So now, the Rashbam already points out that it's an explicit tosefta that describes this case exactly, and so now he's perplexed by why the Gemara has any question, because the tosefta gives us an answer. It says, Omer, tznu chelek leploni b'nechsai, yeresh im abanim. Then he inherits along with the other children. So basically, if he gives a portion of his possessions to so-and-so, then we say that tnu chelek means you get one possession along with the other children that are there. Children each get a portion. You will be one of those apportioned out of the number of people that are there. Chelek means a portion based on what the dividing numbers are already. And since there are other children, if there are three other children, you'll be added in the fray, and that'll be four, divided by four, and each person will get a piece. Hachamayri, go on the late day, b'nei. Either, you have to say here, it's a case where he doesn't have children. And therefore, it's not obvious how to divide up the possessions because of the fact that there aren't children there that give you a natural breakdown or a natural divisor into how to split up the possessions. Inami, hachamayri, go on damar, tznu chelek leploni, b'nai, b'nichsai, v'ashar netunim leploni. Or he says, give this and this section or portion to my children, and the remainder to so-and-so. So that means that whatever his children are getting, then the remainder is going to this other individual. Now we're trying to figure out, what is that portion, or what is that remainder? How does it work? What's the interplay between them? Here he's not giving them a portion alongside the children. He's giving them a portion as opposed to the children. I mean, they'll get one portion, you'll get the other portion. Inami. Igan Amemar, Delavishmiluhu Achbraita. Possibility that the Gemara was not aware of this Tosefta. We know that in general, the Amoraim were aware of all the Mishnayot, but Braitot they weren't always aware of, or Tosefta they're not always aware of. Generally, if it's from Mepchia and Rav Hoshaya, who were the mainstream Braitot, they did know about them. He speculates that maybe they didn't know this Braita. Or the possibility that this Mishnah, or this question that we have in our Gemara now, is according to Sumchus. And that piece in the Tosefta is according to the Rabbonon. Or, the possibility that the Gemara knew about the Tosefta and disagrees with the Tosefta. So here the Rashbam gives you a number of possibilities as to why the Gemara did not bring the Tosefta, which would have been your most obvious answer to the problem, is that the Tosefta addresses this head on. Why didn't they bring it? So he says, either the facts of the case are different, and therefore the Tosefta is not relevant, or the Tosefta is following a different position, versus what our Gemara is doing. Or, our Gemara wasn't aware of the Tosefta, or Paskin's against the Tosefta. So for any one of those reasons, the Gemara did not bring the Tosefta to deal with it. But rather, Amar Ravina Bar Kisi, Tashma, Titania, we have a Braita. Haomer, Tnu Chelek Leploni Bibor, person who says, give a portion of my cistern to so-and-so, Sumchus Omer. Sumchus says, Ein Pachot Mirivia, and then he gets no less than a quarter. Lichavit, he says, put it into my barrel or into my pitcher, Ein Pachot Mishminit, to get no less than an eighth. Likdeira, if he says, put it into the pot, Ein Pachot Miyudbet, you don't get less than 1/12. The Tfiach, if you put it into some sort of drinking cup or a pitcher of sorts, Ein Pachot Mishishasa, you don't get less than 1/16. So now, first of all, over here, in terms of the boar, the Rishbam over here says, and most of the Rishonim believe that the boar that we're speaking about here is a cistern. And therefore, we're talking about water and the dividing up of water or portioning of water. There are those, and you can see that in the Rishbam, he says he rejects those people that say that it was a boar shel yayin, that it was the vat that collects the wine at the end of the pressing process, which is also called a boar. And he says, v'lo nihira, he disagrees with that. The fact that the Rishbam quotes it and disagrees, you know that there are other opinions who think that we're talking about a boar shel yayin. But the mainstream view is that we're talking about a boar shel mayim. Now there are two different ways to deal with what the Gemara says over here. The Rabbeinu Gershom brings one way, which the Rishbam himself quotes at the end and says, v'lo nihira. He disagrees with it wholeheartedly. I'm going to explain his position first just because it's easier to explain, and then we'll go back to the Rishbam's explanation. The Rabbeinu Gershom says over here that the Shiru HaChamim, the Chamim decided what that amount is, Dibirviya Dailo. It's enough for him, or that is the amount that would be required for what is being stated over here. So when he states that he is giving him a certain amount of the water, I am giving you access to the water in my cistern, then he means that he's going to give him enough water to water his fields and to take care of all of his needs, meaning that watering his fields is obviously the biggest usage that you would have out of it. And smaller usages we're going to see as we go along the list over here. So subsumed under this larger use is watering his fields. So the Chachamim had a position, or they assumed that this was the standard protocol, which was that a quarter of the cistern would suffice for you to be able to do that. If he says, Stam, Tnu Chelek Leploni Bebor Bechaviyot, and he says it using a barrel, Ein lo ba pachot michet bo. He only gets 1/8 of it. Shekach hayu rigilim. This is the way that people acted. Shememalim chaviyoteim mayim. Lehistapek mimeno kol hashana letzorach rechitzat bigadim vekelim. So they used to take or buy a portion from the boar, in which they would use all the water from there for their basic needs. Laundry, for drinking, for washing, so on and so forth. And then you move on to keteira, which is for your food needs or for your cooking needs. And then you move on to tfiach, which is for your drinking needs. So the basic, the least shiur that you would have is for your drinking needs. After that, you would graduate for your cooking needs. After that, you would graduate for your laundering and washing needs. And then after that, you graduate for your watering of your fields. So each one of those usages has a greater need for water. So when a person either buys a portion or is granted a portion in a cistern for doing whatever this is, there are one of two ways to express it. The Rabbeinu Gershom expressed it. One way is Shiru HaChamim, that the Chamim said that that is the amount that you should get. That would suffice for you to do whatever these jobs are, or whatever is being allocated over here. The other way to express it is that it was a standard that was known. I mean, that people knew if you bought a share in a cistern for drinking water, you got 1/16 of the cistern. You bought a share for washing your clothes and your kelim, then you got 1/8 of the boar. So on and so forth. So either way, it's an expression that brings with it a fixed amount that should be apportioned based on what you are stating. So then the Gemara is bringing an answer to this, that you have to look at these cases of Tnu Chelek. Tnu Chelek has some sort of standard amount that people use. Either that's Shiro Chachamim. Chachamim have to decide what that amount is, and then they assign that as being the normal number that everybody uses. Or there is some sort of social agreement, social contract between parties, and this is how they purchase water from cisterns, is based on these numbers. And that means in our case, when he says give him a portion of it, it's as if he's giving him a quarter. And so just like the case by Tnu Chelek Babor results in a quarter, so too of the case of Tnu Chelek Benichsai will result in a quarter. But for the remaining measurements that are in this Braita, none of this is extrapolable to anywhere else, because it's unique to the case of a cistern. And therefore, these calculations, as well as the expressions that are used here, what a chavit means, what a tefiach means, are all unique to this circumstance, and you would not apply it to anywhere else. You would have to come up with whatever the chelik is that would be appropriate in this situation. So now, that's the way that they explain it. But in that way, two things happen. Again, it's not extrapolable. Number two is, this is Simchus stating an opinion, but it doesn't reflect Simchus's position anywhere else in Shas. What the Rashbam suggests over here is that this is Simchus l'shitato. We know Simchus all over Shas, that Simchus argues on the Chachamim as to what you do when you have a safek. Mamon hamutal bisafek. You have a question as to what to do, whether it's in a case in halacha, you don't know what the right halachic psak is, or in a case in the facts of the case, don't have us, give us the ability to adjudicate, and we're left bisafek. What do you do in those cases? The Rabbanim believe, amotzi michaveiro alav araya. Whoever wants to move it from the position that's in and the person who's mukzak in it, you've got to bring the proof. The burden of proof is on the one who wants to extract the money in that case. Simchus has an alternate opinion. We've bumped into him a number of times, especially in Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, that a maman hamutal b'safek is chokim, that you split it. You split the item between the two parties. So that's what the Rashbam suggests over here, that this is Simchus l'shitato. This is Simchus l'shitato, is we don't know what you mean when you say tnu chelek. There are two possibilities about what you mean with tnu chelek. One possibility is these amounts that are listed here, which we're going to see in a second. Or the other possibility is mashu, something, the least amount. When you say give me a portion or a portion, a piece of it, a piece can mean just the most minute piece, or it can be some sort of standard. So that's what he says here. When you say tznu chelek toponi babor, give him a portion of the cistern, and again here, it's if it's to water the fields, whatever the reason is, the Rashbam is following the sheet of the Rabbeinu Hananel, who says this is simchus shitoto, but also says that these measurements were also standard measurements, which is that if you bought a boar to water your fields or take care of your fields, you bought a portion of the boar, you would get 50% of it. So if I have a possibility that either he meant 50% or he meant the most minute amount, what's splitting that? Turns out to be a revia, a quarter, because it's a mamona mutal b'safek. I don't know if I should give you 50% of the boar or should I give you like a little piece of the boar, the smallest amount of water. The half of that would be a revia. The truth is, it would be a little more than that. It'd be a revia plus a mashu. The Gemara doesn't mention the mashu. And that's what it means, ain't pachot mi revia. That you get no less than a quarter, because that is the split. That's a chance, 50-50 of what you could have gotten. Li chavit, ain't pachot mi shminit. For a chavit, it's half that amount. Instead of being a half of the boar, it's a quarter of the boar. Therefore, I have a choice between the quarter of the boar being yours, or the most minute amount. 50% of that, meaning if I split that, b'safek, you end up with 1/8 of the boar. Lik de ra, you get 1/6 of the boar. And now I have 1/6 or a mashu, or the equivalent of 1/6 or zero, or two options over here. Half of that is 1/12. And litviach, you were entitled to 1/8 of the boar, but we don't know if he gave him 1/8 of the boar, if he gave him the least amount, and therefore he gets 1/16. So the way that the Rashbam views this, it's important. First of all, this is Simchus l'shitato, all over Shas. That Simchus believes that Mamon amutal b'safek chokim. And over here, we have a problem. We don't know what he gave him when he said chelek. The least amount is a mashu. The maximum amount are these standard measurements. And that's what the Rabbeinu Hananel says. Now, the Rabbeinu Hananel's standard measurements are bigger than the other Rishonim because he has to end up with these numbers being 50% of the standard number. Whereas the other Rishonim, we see these being the shiurim themselves, that they give out as a standard basis. So as he following the Rabbeinu Hananel Shita, that's how the Rashbam explains it, that this is all Simchus l'shitato. And on that, the Rashbam says, V'kaimalon, kisumchus, damar mamanu mutal b'safek chokim, destamlan k'tana kavatei. Because the stam mishnayot in Shas, including in Baba Kama, follow this position of Simchus. So first of all, the Rashbam does two things here. He explains the Gemara according to Rabbeinu Hananel, who says this is Simchus l'shitato. And that's why you would get a quarter here, because we have a safek between giving you a kol shehu or a half of the property. And the mamon mutal b'safek chokim, that results in you getting a quarter in this instance. And then he says that has implications because we paskin like Simchus. And all over Shas, when you have mamon mutal b'safek chokim, that would be the result, or that would be the halacha that we paskin based on this. This Rashbam is difficult for a number of reasons. First of which is, we just saw the Rashbam in yesterday's daf. In the end of Shudah D'Dayne, the Rashbam said over there that the Gemara concluded Shudah D'Dayne, which was a questionable expression as to whether that was the Gemara itself, or was that, the Ramban says, was added in by the Gaonim later on, and that was what they said they should do in this case. And aside from the fact that Shuddah Dedaini means different things in different places, where you have Machlok and Rishonim, so what it means here, most of the Rishonim agree that Shuddah Dedaini means that Dayanim should figure out who it makes sense to give it to, or who is the more deserving party. But then the Rashbam writes that that is not a standard by which we make decisions in cases of Safek. He says, that's only in this case, because the Gemara says Shuddah Dedaini. Had it not been for the Shuddah Dedaini, then, Miu B'Shar Mekamot, in any other place in Shas, the Misfekalan betray Lishne, where we have a Safek between two Lishonot, Hilchakat Keman, Lo Amrin and Shuddah Dedaini. We don't say that it's a Shuddah Dedaini. Ad Shiv Faresh, Ki Hocha, Ela Motzimi Chaver Olav Araya. There we say that it's a Motzimi Chaver Olav Araya, whenever we have a Safek between two Lishonot Gemara. So what you see from the Rashbam over there is that the standard is Motzimi Chaver Olav Araya, Elam Kain, the Gemara comes along and says, Shuddah Dedaini, to tell you otherwise. So here the Rashbam seems to paskin that it is a Motzimi Chaver Olav Araya. Over here he's saying that Safek Chokim. Now you could argue that the difference is that over there, the Gemara has a Safek in the Halacha. And the Gemara doesn't know whether to go with the Lishna Rishon of Rava or the Lishna Batra of Rava. And then given that, you have a Safek in the Halacha. So it might be that he believes that Motzi Mechavero Alavarai applies in a Safek in Halacha, but when you have a Safek in the Din, like over here, where we don't know what the outcome is, we know what the Halacha is, we just don't know what the Din should be, because we have a Safek between the two parties, over there you say Chokim. That's a little difficult, because it's not clear why you would differentiate between different types of Safekot. Why in one Safek we'd say Motzi Mechavero Alavarai, and over here in this Safek you'd say Mamona Mutav Safek Chokim, but that might be a way to deal with that stira in the Rashbam. On the other hand, it's clear from the Bali HaTosafot on yesterday's daf, the Itmar on Samach Bera Midbet, as well as the Bali HaTosafot back on Lamed Hayom and Aleph, they go out of their way to show that that's not the case. That the standard in Shas is anytime you have a Safek, Hamutzi Michavero, Alav Araya. Eliyim Kain, the Shas tells you otherwise. The Shas tells you otherwise, there are two possibilities, either Shuddah Dedaini, or Mamonu Mutuah B'Safek, Chokim. And there are some places in Shas where the Gemara comes to the conclusion, the Chokim. But those are the exceptions to the rule. That's not paskening like Sumchus. And the Bali HaTosafot and the majority of the Rishonim disagree with the Rashbam and the Rabbeinu Kanan are saying here that the Halacha is like Sumchus all over Shas. So because of this Stam Lan Kavateh, which is this Stam Mishnah that seems to follow Sumchus in Baba Kama, and therefore based on that, they extrapolate to say that that would be the din throughout Shas. The Bali HaTosafot here, on Samach Ben Amud Bet, as well as on Lamed Hayam and Aleph, say that's not the case. And the standard is a motzi mechavero lavaraya. That's why they're going to come up with a different explanation of this braita, and not say this is sumchos l'shita to, but rather come up with an explanation for this braita that would be applicable even if you don't hold of sumchos, even if you don't hold the mamon butal for safek is chokim. The Bali HaTosafot say there's no difference between a safek in halacha, a safek in the din as to the facts of the case. In either of those cases, a safek is always met with a motzi mechavero, a lavaraya, because we paskin like the chachamim. And so you can see that in the Bali HaTosafot on the top of Samach Gimel, where he says that, Pasak Rabbeinu Shmuel Shreitin, the Chol Alim Govar, the Locha Kusumchus, Nira Dein Locha Kusumchus, Kumel Shiparashti, Becheskat Abatim. He says that, I explained to you in Cheskat Abatim, in Lamed Hey, I explained to you in yesterday's daf, Locha is not like Sumchus, and therefore he disagrees with the Rashbam's conclusion. And for that reason, you could come up, or you would come up with a different explanation of the Gemara, although the Bali HaTosafot do accept the explanation of the Rashbam here, even though it may not be the Halacha. So it turns out that you could hold like Sumchos and say, Sumchos L'shita To, but it doesn't have application because it's not the Halacha. That's what the Rashbam said before. Maybe we hold like the Rabbanan and not like Sumchos, and the Tosefta is like the Rabbanan, and this Breita is like Sumchos. That there is a Machloket, and that might be the position of the Bali HaTosafot. The Rashbam and the Rabbeinu Chananel say the Halacha is like Sumchus, and this is Sumchus L'shita To. We saw in the Rabbeinu Gershom and other Rishonim that say that this is totally, has nothing to do with Mamon HaMutal B'Safek. This is Sumchus giving us a din, not related to his other din of Mamon HaMutal B'Safek, but rather, these are the measurements that the Chachamim, Shiuru Chachamim, that these are the measurements, or that this is the standard policy between peoples. When they sold these amounts, this is what they would sell. These are the percentages they would sell out of the boar. Nothing to do with a safek. All right, Tan Rabbanan. Ben Levi, Shemachar Sadeh L'Yisrael. Ben Levi sells his field to a Yisrael. V'amar lo, amanat, Shemaser Rishon Shili. But I'm going to maintain the rights to the Maaser Rishon. Maaser Rishon Shilo, he gets to keep the Maaser Rishon. So here, this Levi owns the field right now. When he separates out the Maaser Rishon at this point in time, he can keep it for himself because he is a Levi. So when he harvests the field and then he separates out the Trumot to Masrot, he gives away the Trumot, but the Maaser Rishon, which goes to Levi, he kept for himself. He sells the field now to a third party, to Israel. The truth is that the Rashbam says it doesn't matter if it's a Levi selling it. For one reason, it mentions a Levi over here. We'll explain in a second. But he says even if Israel is selling it, he can retain this right for himself, which is the Tovat Hana, it's called. The ability to determine where the Maaser Rishon goes, to who you give the Maaser Rishon. You have the right to retain that right. Over here, the Levi has a greater vested interest in doing that, because not only does he have the right to give it, but he can keep it for himself. He can eat it himself then. So that's why he'd want to do this. So now he sells the field, and he says to the buyer, listen, you buy the field, but just give me the Maaser Rishon from the field. All the Maaser Rishon in the field will belong to me. So now, from the buyer's perspective, the Rashbam says that it's no skin off his back. He has to give away the Maaser Rishon anyway. Zenenev is a lo chaser. The Rashbam says he's not going to reduce the price. That's why the Gemara gave the explanation in this manner, is because he'll pay the same amount to buy the field and give the Maaser Rishon to the seller versus buying the field and give the Maaser Rishon to whoever he chooses, that he won't make a difference to him, so he won't reduce the price. Other Rishonim believe that he will reduce the price. There is some consideration for it. The Tovat Hana, which is the ability to determine who it goes to, so he will reduce the price, even though it'll be minimal. But the Rashbam goes out of his way to suggest that the case here is a case where Zen Enev is a little chaser, and therefore he won't even take off the price. And that's why the Gemara gave this as the scenario. Even though it's true, if Israel sold it to another Israel, no matter who sells it, you could set up this structure. Now, the structure is problematic, and that's what the Gemara is going to have to deal with in a second. V'yamar li ulevanai, if he says, for me and my children, mate, itein levanav. If the Levi passes away, the owner of the field will have to continue to give it to the children of this Levi. Ima marlo kozman shasadeh zo biyadecha. If the stipulation was, as long as this field is in your possession, you will give me the Maaser Rishon from it. Machra, if he sells it, v'chazar v'lakha, and then he repurchased it, ein lo alav klum. Then he has no rights to him, because he only maintained the rights as long as he owned it. As soon as he sold it, those rights were forfeited. When he buys it back, then he's buying whatever rights the other individual has. The other individual has the rights free and clear of this Levi, and when he buys it back, that's what he gets back. He sold it, and then the Levi's rights terminated. And now, when he buys it back, the Levi's rights don't get reinstated all of a sudden because he's buying the rights that the third party got from his selling it to him. When he sold it to the third party, he had it free and clear of this Levi. So now when he buys it back, he buys it back with all those rights of free and clear. And therefore, the Levi has no rights. The Rabbeinu Gershom says that, Aval, Heicher Damar Stam, Amanat Shem Aser Aninotel, if without any stipulation about, as long as you own the field, he just simply sells it on this condition, Akam Agav Damachra, even though he sold it, Ho V'chazer V'lacha Shalolo, when he buys it back, it will be his. Now, I'll be honest with you, the Rabbeinu Gershom is somewhat difficult to understand. We'll see in a second why. But he says that if this stipulation wasn't made, that as long as you own the field, then it means that as long as you have possession of this field, you will have to give the Maaser Rishon to the Levi. So that means if you sell it and buy it back, you'll have to give it back to him because you own the field. The problem is, how did he sell the field with the Maaser Rishon rights gone? I mean, when he sold the field, he didn't own the Maaser Rishon rights. So he sold it to this other party. The Maaser Rishon rights should stay with the Levi. It should have never left the Levi's possession, because he didn't have a right to sell it. He didn't own those rights to sell those rights. So he sells it to whoever it is. Then when he buys it back, what he sold to him was the rights without the Maaser Rishon. When he buys it back without the rights to the Maaser Rishon. But that means that the Levi should get the Maaser Rishon all through this. I mean, that even when he sells it to another party, even with the other party, because how could he sell a right he doesn't own? You can only sell something you own. If the Maaser Rishon is retained by the Levi, how do you sell something that's owned by the Levi? That'll become more apparent in the Gemara in 1 second, which is that it's not simply a condition, it is a right that he owns. If he has that right, you don't have a right to terminate his right or to sell his right away. So again, I'm not sure if the Rabbeinu Gershom is because you sell it to the other party, buy it back, you have to keep giving it to Levi. It might be that even when the other party has it, when you sell it to that third party, he might also have to give the Maaser Rishon to Levi, because I don't think he can sell this right. It doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the Levi. So, Abai, why is this work? We have a number of problems here as to why this works. One is, Ein Adam Makneh Davar Shelo Ba'alei Olam. This Levi is maintaining or retaining a right of something that has yet to exist. The Maaser Rishon will be in the future. This is not a case where it exists already. He's talking about future crops that are going to come off of this field. I have this right to the Maaser Rishon. He's buying something, Shelo Ba'alei Olam, that doesn't exist yet. He's buying an intangible right, something that he cannot put his finger on, not something that is tangible that you're buying. And therefore, it should fail just on that grounds, that he's unable to buy Davar Shelo Ba'alei Olam. The Ba'alei Tosafot point out over here that the Gemara did not answer that this is Shitat Rabbi Meir, who believes in other places in Shas, that you can be Makmeh Davar Shelo Ba'alei Olam. Because he says over here, even Rabbi Meir would agree that there's a problem, because Rabbi Meir only agrees Davar Shelo Ba'alei Olam, for instance, is Dekel Peirutav, where you sell a palm tree for its fruit. It's something that Ati Le'avdei, so that would automatically happen, which is that since you have a palm tree, therefore the fruits will come out. That's almost a given, and therefore you can sell the rights to that Davar Shelo Ba'alei Olam. On the other hand, over here, you're talking about a field where there's nothing in it. So he's buying the rights to the produce that comes afterwards. Even if the produce was up to the point of shachat, it still might be problematic because there's so much risk. First of all, we don't know if the guy's going to plant the field. Even if he does plant the field, who says it's going to grow? Even if it starts growing, who says it's going to survive? I mean, it's not automatically ate de avde. And therefore, you even according to Rabbi Meir, you would not be able to sell this because it's davar shelo ba'alei olam. Or it suggests over here that Rabbi Meir, even though he says you're allowed to sell davar shelo ba'alei olam, you can't sell anything to someone that is enu ba'olam, someone that's not here. And in our case over here, it was a case where he makes them say li ulevanai. When he uses the expression for me and my children, then he does have a right to grant that right to his children, even though they don't exist right now. They're not born yet. Now, the easy answer to that position is to say that he's talking about his children that are already extant, that are already born. So that's not necessarily an upending of that position, but the Ba'alei Tosafot, for one of those two reasons, suggests that Rabbi Meir can't be the author of this position. Kevan, da'amarle amanat, shemaser rishon shili, since he made this a condition of the sale, shiure share la makom maser, he leaves behind ownership of the land. So this is the way that the sale goes through, and this is why what I was saying before will become much more clear, is that when he sells the land, then Merlevi is saying, I'm selling you the rights to land, but I am maintaining the rights to the Maaser Rishon. How do you maintain rights to a Maaser Rishon if it's a Davar Shelo Ba'alei Olam? He basically retains 10% of the land. He retains ownership over 10% of the land. And he says, I'm selling you 90% of the land or production of the land. I'm keeping the 10% of that production. That 10% production I'll let you use or utilize as your Maaser Rishon. So then you'll utilize that as your Maaser Rishon and you'll pay me out of that. So he retains a physical ownership in the land. There are different ways to express this. The way that the Rashbam expresses this is that it comes or derives from the Yitur HaLashon. It comes from the extraneous expression. The Rashbam says this in a number of times here, but it's clear from our Mishnah and from other places that if you say things that are unnecessary in the contract, that means that you are looking for more, or you're looking to have more come out of whatever it is. And that's what he says over here as well, which is that Kevin Mishum Yitur Lishonhu, because there's an extra statement over here, then what are we doing for him? Because if we just leave it as a condition in the sale, it will fail. If the Levi sells the property and says, I want the Maaser Rishon, it's going to fail. The fact that he stated something extra and said, I want to retain the rights to the Maaser Rishon, how do we make it work? So the only way to make it work is to have it be that he retains ownership in the land. And that's how we're going to explain it over here. He retains a portion of the land to himself because he used this extra language. Now, the minimum amount that we're going to give him is that he himself is entitled to the Maaser Rishon. But his children, forget about it. They're not going to get the Maaser Rishon. After that, he says, Li ulevanai, for me and my children, then you have another extra language that's put in. Because Li, it would have been enough if he just said it without saying Li. The fact that he said Li ulevanai means that he's asking for something more. How do we explain that extra language? We say we're going to give it to him and to his children. So that's how we'll make it work. But the Rashbam says the whole thing revolves around whether you are saying something extra or not saying something extra. Every time you say something extra, and the Tznai would fail if we leave it as it is, we have to make a way or figure out a way to have it function. So over here, if you simply said, oh, there's a condition that I keep my Maaser Rishon, the Tznai would fail. But then why did he put that in? If he knew the Tznai was going to fail, why would he put such a condition in? Must be that they want something to work. How do we make it work? We give him a portion of the property. We give him ownership in the property. If he adds on the word Bavanai, we give it even more. We give it to him and to his children are entitled to collect the Maaser Rishon for this property. He says, Ve'itim Mefarshim, he says, there are those that say, De'itur Lashon Almanat, that it comes from the word Almanat, Kadayik, Kedarminim Ba'alma, we saw in the Gemara in Kedushin and other places, that Almanat is Kimi Akshav Domi. It's as if he says, from now until then, Ve'yev Shalamit, Shitat Shmot Zokain. He says, it's impossible to set up the sugya like this. It has nothing to do with the word Almanat. Hilkach Lab Lashon Almanat Tal Yamilta. It has nothing to do with using the term Almanat. The only way to make the Tanai work is to have him take a residual ownership in the property. That's what we say he did. He took a residual piece in the property. So the Rashbam's view is it all derives from the Yitur HaLashon. It all derives from this extraneous language that he's putting in. And we have to figure out, or Beitin's got to figure out how to make it work. The only way to make it work is to give him residual ownership in the property. Now, once you give him residual ownership in the property, it's somewhat questionable as to why it wouldn't automatically go to his children. If it is an ownership in the property, his children should inherit that ownership in the property. So then why does he have to specify Li Ulavanai? So the Rashbam dealt with the problem and said that we give him the minimum amount. Because since his Tanai all comes, the Yitur HaLashon, this extraneous language is what determines, we give him the minimum amount to make the Tanai work. So in a case where he just says it's Stam, we say the minimum amount is to give it to him, for the ownership just for his lifetime. When he dies, it's going to terminate. That's the minimum amount to make the Tanai work. He adds in Banai, that'll add it on. But for other Rishonim who disagree with the Rishbam, and don't say that it comes out of the Yitur Lashon, but rather this was the condition of sale. Now, it cannot just be the condition of sale, because if you use the word Almanat, a Tanai, a condition could be in Davar Shelo Ba'alei Olam. If it's simply a condition in the sale, a condition be premised on something that has yet to exist. You can't have a sale over something that doesn't exist. But you can have conditions that will happen in the future. So that can't be the explanation that you're talking about a real Tanai over here. And therefore, what the interpretation is, it's not a Tanai, but a residual in the contractual obligations between the parties. He's saying to him, I'm selling you the property with the exception of this piece. He's not saying on the condition that you give me the Maaser Rishon, but rather with the exception of this piece. If that's the way you explain it, according to those Rishonim, why is it if he has ownership in the land, can he not pass that to his children? So there are two ways to deal with that. One is to say that he doesn't have real Yerusha over here. He doesn't own the land. He has a shibud on the land. He has a cumbrance on the land to get his Maaser Rishon, but he doesn't literally own the underlying land, and that's why he can't pass it as Yerusha. Or the other way to express it is that he has a right here. He's not buying the actual land. He has a right to the Maaser Rishon, that right you don't pass to children. Rights don't pass to children, only property passes to children. So for either way that you explain it, those Rishonim believe you can't pass it to your child. Elaim Kain, you express it explicitly, and you leave your children also rights or ownership in the land. Otherwise it will terminate with you because that's all you bought. You either bought an encumbrance or you bought a right to the land. You bought nothing more than that, and you can't pass that to your children. The last question to deal with is what David was asking, which is, how do you have Maaser Rishon be taken off of this property? There are two issues here. One is, Kohen HaMisayeh B'Granot, that there is a restriction, very likely a restriction de'oraita, for a Kohen to go and help out with the harvest, and then get paid the trumot and all the matnot kihuna out of the harvest. That's called a Kohen HaMisayeh B'Granot. He goes to help out the balabayit in his goren, in his threshing floor, and the final stages of the processing. And as remuneration for that, he gets the trumot. Then basically what the Baal HaBayit is doing is discharging his obligations with truma, which is not the case. Truma is tmurat, the work of Kodesh that the Kohanim do and the Levim do. It's not tmurat, the work they do for you. And therefore, it's illegal for them to take it in that way. So why isn't this called Kohen HaMisayeh B'Granot? Here the Levi is selling it, and then he's expecting his Maaser Rishon back. So isn't that considered to be Kohen HaMisayeh B'Granot? So one of the answers has to do with what the Rashbam said before, which is that there's no reduction in price over here. There's no Kohen HaMisayeh B'Granot because the Yisrael won't take the price down because of the fact that he's taking the Maaser Rishon. The Yisrael's going to lose the Maaser Rishon either way. Since there's no reduction in price, then there's no discount. He's not buying the Maaser Rishon because he's paying the same amount for the property he would have paid whether he gave up the Maaser Rishon or didn't. So therefore, there's no paying for it. It's not considered to be Kohen HaMisayeh B'Granot. When the Levi gets this, he's not getting this because he discounted the property. He's getting this because he made that condition. He kept the residual ownership. So that's one way to avoid the problem of Kohen Amaseye Bigranot. The other way to deal with it is if you believe there is a discount in the price, is to say that Kohen Amaseye Bigranot has to be something where it's obvious that it is remuneration for work that he's doing in particular for you. As the Balei Tosafot suggests over here, the reason that there's no problem of Kohen Amaseye Bebeit HaGranot is based on the conclusion of the Gemara that the Levi owns the property. You only claim, or you can ask Kohen Amaseye Bigranot if he's working in someone else's property and then taking it. Over here, in the end, it's his property, it's his item, and therefore he's not classified as a Kohen Amaseye Bigranot. Now, the last problem, the secondary problem you have to deal with is how do you take off Maaser Rishon from someone else's property or someone else's peirot? The owner or the buyer here doesn't own this property. The Levi owns the property. So you have to express it in one of two ways. For the Rishonim, we say that the ownership in the land here is not real, that it's really just a right, a shibud, an encumbrance. Or there are those that express it, even if he has rights of ownership, the ownership is not determined. It's not a distinct piece of property. It is 10% of the property, but we have no idea where that 10% is. It's some 10% in there. Then the ownership is much less tight on the land, and therefore it's really a right that he owns in many ways, and that's why he can't pass it to his children. But that would also be the reason why he could be mafrish the masrot. The easier way to deal with that, even if you believe he has real ownership in the land, is that you're allowed to give someone else rights to borrow your property, or to borrow your produce, or to utilize your produce. You have a right to go into someone else's property and say, listen, you have to be mafrish trumot masrot. I'm going to grant you those out of my produce. You want to be mafrish? I'm going to be mafrish trumot masrot on your behalf. I'm going to grant you the ownership of those items so that you can be mafrish trumot masrot. And that's basically what the Levi does over here. The Levi says, yes, it's my land. That 10% is mine. But I'm going to grant you the right to utilize the output of this property for your own purposes. How does he use it for his own purposes? He uses it to dig off his trumot and masrot. Here is Maaser Rishon. And therefore, that's how he facilitates the ability to do this, even though he doesn't own that tract of land. Yisrael doesn't own the tract of land, but the Levi is granting him the ability to utilize it in that way. That's the stipulation of the agreement. I will own the land, but you will have the right to utilize the produce of that land for your benefit, to make it into Maaser Rishon. So he grants him enough rights there, or ownership there, in order to be mafrish, the trumot, and masrot. So now the Gemara says, Amar Reish Lakish, zot omeret. From this you could extrapolate, from this din that we just learned here, you can extrapolate. Amocher bait lechaveiro, someone who sells a house to his friend, v'amarlo amnat shediuta elyona sheli. As long as the upper diuta is mine, diuta elyona shelo, then the diuta elyona will be his. Mayochata. Why does it matter that the diuta elyona is his? Zvid amar shimratza latzoi bam zizin motzi. If he wants to have zizim, these ledges, or these protrusions, projections come out of the property, he will have a right to do this. Alright, so now let's go. Again, we're going to have here a major machloket in the Rishonim. He has to explain what the diuta elyona is. The word diuta, other places in Shas, means row. Means the row or level. So over here, the Rabbeinu Tam, you can't see it here, it's at the bottom of Samach Dalet Amud Aleph, the Rabbeinu Tam explains literally that the diuta over here means he maintained for himself the top level, the top row of bricks on the house. So that's what the Gemara wants to know. Okay, so he retained ownership of the top level of bricks on the house. What good is that? Why would you maintain for yourself the top level of bricks in the house? The answer is, Lotzi Zizim, because he wants to use that to put on ledges or have things stick out that he can utilize and have that be to his benefit. So that would be the explanation of the Rabbeinu Tam. That's only the Rabbeinu Tam. The majority of Rishonim disagree with that. That includes here the Rashbam, the Balei HaTosafot, the Ri. Everybody disagrees with that. And they say that Diuto Eliona means an upper chamber. Here there's a question as to whether it means it's a second level. The roof is the top level of the house because that has utility. If you have walls around it, it's a flat roof. Others say that Diuto Eliona does not literally mean the Aliyah, the upper level, but means smaller. It's not like a full aliyah. It's almost like an attic. The equivalent of what would be under the steepness of the roof, where you have an attic that's not a living space, but more like a storage space, like a crawl space above in the attic. So that's the diuta elyona that we're speaking about over here. And then again, what's the purpose of that? And that is the hotzi ba zizim, is to put on zizim that he's maintaining that right. So now, as the Rashbam points out, that the reason that this works is the Rashbam Lashitato again, which is that you have Iter Alashon, extraneous language which isn't necessary, which is over here, he's maintained the rights to Diyuta Elyona, The Diyut El Yona right now, the Rishpam assumes, is the roof. The roof is the highest point or the top level of the house, because that has utility. If you have walls around it, it's a flat roof, then in that area you can utilize it. And he says, but even if you never stipulated that in your statement, you would get the gag. That was our first Mishnah in the Perek. First Mishnah in the Perek says, Mocher Tabait, Lo Machar Tagag. You sell the house, you don't sell the roof. So you would retain that for yourself anyway. So when I say, and I make a condition that I'm maintaining for myself, Diyut El Yona, it must be something in excess of the roof. What is that that's in excess of the roof? Those are the Zizim that are coming out of this area. So therefore, he maintains or regains an extra right, which is the right to put in Zizim over here based on that Diyut El Yona. What these Zizim are for, that is a good question. The Rishbam believes over here that the right to put out Zizim is that even though he sold him the house and he sold the chatzer down below, because you have to assume, the Rishbam himself doesn't say it, but other Rishonim that take up the position of the Rishbam say this, that even though we said in the first Mishnah in the Perek that if you sell the house, you don't necessarily sell the chatzer with it. So then that's why the Baal Tosafot think that the Rishbam's explanation makes no sense, is because the issue is that he sold him the house doesn't mean he has the chatzer. The Mocher kept the rights to the chatzer. If you have the chatzer, you also have the airspace rights to the chatzer. Therefore, if you put out these zizim into the chatzer, that's your property. That's your airspace. What's the question over here? You could have done that even without the tnai. What you have to say for the Rishbam is that most people, when they buy a house, buy a courtyard with the house. Because if you remember, in their day, the courtyard was really an extension of the house. Their kitchen was not in the house. The kitchen was out in the courtyard. If you bought a house without a courtyard, you were buying half a house. You were buying just a sleeping area. You weren't buying the utility that people have that comes with the courtyard. So what you have to assume is he sold them the house and the courtyard. When he sells them the courtyard, then it means that he sold them the air rights above the courtyard. That means that the zizim that project out, he could not put there. Even though when you sell the house, you don't sell the roof, so you'd have the right to the roof, but you wouldn't have the right to use the airspace that extends outward from the roof, because that would go over the chatzer of the buyer. And that's what it means you retain the right to the zizim. That is what the Rashbam claims, is that you retain the right to extend the zizim over the other person's chatzer. And that's the right. The Baal Tosafot disagree for the, what I explained now, which is that in the case where you sell a house, you don't sell the roof, but you also don't sell the chatzer. That means that the seller retained the chatzer and the roof, and therefore what does he need the right to put out zizim there? He has that right anyway. The gag is his, and the chatzer is his. So why is there any question about what he can use over here? And therefore the Baal Tosafot believe that the Otsi Zizim is, in Fresh Ratam, Otsi Bazizim, Haya Bonet Binyan Bechatzer. He's building a Binyan in the Chatzer, and he wants to put it on the roof, or he wants to lean it on those Zizim. He can use those Zizims for structural support. So the maintaining of the right is, you have one of two options here, explain the Reino Tam, is if you want to build up above the Gag, then you can build up above the Gag and use the Zizim as the structural support for whatever you build above. Or in essence, you've gotten the right to put something on top of the walls below. The walls below belong to the house. And if you put something on top, that means that you're putting weight. And these walls will now have to bear the weight of whatever you build on top. Maintaining that right of the zizim is exactly what you maintained. You maintained the right to put weight on those walls. You maintained the right to build on top of them. You can express it in one or two ways. Either he builds on top of it, where he rests it on the zizim, or he's building adjacent to it in the chatzer. And he wants to, whatever he's building in the chatzer, he wants to place and connect to this house. So use this wall as part of it. He can extend zizim out of the wall to hold up the cross beams, to hold up something that he's building next to it, because he maintained the right to put weight onto those walls. And that's what it means, he maintains the right to the zizim. So that's the view of the Baal Tosafot as to what it means to maintain the right to the zizim. The Rashbam on the other hand says it's to utilize the zizim. And again, you'd have to explain there that he lost the rights to the chatzer. He sold the rights to the chatzer. The Baal Tosafot believe that if you sell a house, you don't sell the gag, you don't sell the chatzer. That means he still has rights to both of those. So therefore the zizim have to have something else that he's giving him. And that is the right to put bare weight on that wall down below, even though those walls don't belong to him. Now their alternative is, Rav Papa Amar, Shim Rotza Livnot Aliyah Al Gaba, he wants to build another level on top of it, Boneh. He has a right to do so. Now, all the Rishonim believe that Rav Papa is Lekula, which is that means that Rav Papa says you get less rights than that of Rav Zvid. But that's hard to understand. Rav Zvid said you could just use the Zizim. Rav Papa says you could build a whole new building on top of it. So what does that mean that he's only giving him less rights over here? So the Rashbam explains it based on the conclusion of the Gemara later on in Samach Dalet Amud Aleph. Before the Mishnah, the Gemara says that if it falls down, he has a right to rebuild it. But Papa is not granting you the right to build now on top of the house. You cannot put on another level on top of the house because that's not granted you. That'd be a huge right. That'd be something extreme in nature to grant someone such a right that he can build another level on top just because he says, I get to keep the Diyuta Yelonyona. That seems way too much. So what either of Shpam says is that he has a right that if the Diyuta itself collapses, then you have a right to rebuild it. And that's the way he reads the Gemara at the end of today's daf before the Mishnah. Although other Rishonim believe that it's a right that if the house falls down, then when the house is rebuilt, you have a right to then build the Diyuta on top of the new house or new structure that's there. That depends on the girsa of the Gemara that you have at the end. The Rishbam follows the girsa of the Rabbeinu Chananel, while others follow the girsa that we have in our Gemara, as to whether it says de'inafla or de'inafil. That if the building falls down, and then they rebuild the building, he has a right to put up the gag again. He has a right to put back his place on top of the house. Because if he had not stated it, and the house fell down, then yes, he would have maintained the gag, because when you sell the house, you don't sell the gag, but you have no rights then, after this house falls down, to then put up a new gag when the house falls down. Because your right was only there as long as the gag existed. You didn't buy the continuing rights that if it goes up again, that you can put up another gag. Almanat gives you that right. It gives you that extra right that if the house comes down, now you can put something up on top of it. The problem with that is the last parak in Bava Metzia, which is when you have a bayit v'aliyah. When you have two parties that share rights, one owns the bayit, one owns the aliyah, then if the house falls down, then the aliyah, the person who owns the aliyah can demand that the person put up the house so he can have his aliyah. If he doesn't, then he can build the house and then put the aliyah up and live downstairs until the other party comes. But there he had a right, even after it fell down, to maintain the upper right. So what you're going to have to do now is distinguish between that case in bayit v'aliyah and our case over here. And that's what the Rashbam says over here. But bayit v'aliyah shel shnayim shenaflu. Imamar b'aliyah b'alabayit livnot. Hatam b'dechalku zenatal bayit zenatal aliyah. Over there, it was a split of the property. It wasn't that he sold them the property and then maintained some rights here. There was a case where they divided ownership. One got the upstairs, one got the downstairs. Because in that split is built in this idea that there is a shibud, that the house is meshubad to the aliyah, and as long as this person owns the aliyah, he has a right to demand that the bayit be there, or that the bayit support his aliyah. Even if there was no explicit condition, when they split it, that is the given right that you have here. But over here, that's not the case, because the right here is a right that's residual in your sale. Wasn't that you split it or you bought a right over here? You maintained this right. In maintaining that right, all you maintained was the right to use it while it's there. You don't maintain a right to use it if it falls down, and that's what the condition adds for you. Amat Diyuta adds on that additional amount. Rav Zvid disagrees with that. That's what the Rashbam says. It says that that's some sort of future right. That's something that may never come to fruition. People retain for themselves rights that are tangible and usable right away. So Rav Zvid says he retained the right to the Zizim, because that's something that you could use right away. That's something that's immediate. He's not going to worry about if it falls down, then I can put up and I'm maintaining that right. That's too far-fetched. The other end of a Papa says Zizim is too explicit a right to take over here. We want to give him the smallest chiddush to make his tenai come true. The smallest chiddush to make his tenai come true is to say that he only get that right when it falls down, not right now. That is the view of the Rashbam as to what Rav Papa is saying over here. On the other hand, the Baliyat Tosafot, he says, V'omer Rabbeinu Yitzchak, da davke baliyah, da difa v'chashiva tvei midiyuta. He says that habayit baliyah, the difference between our case over here and the case in Baba Metzia about habayit baliyah is that in that case, you're talking about a significant space. You're talking about a bayit and an aliyah, which is basically a duplex. You're dealing with one house on top of another house. When you own the upper house, that is a significant item that you own up there. That significant item encumbers the lower house to the upper house in the duplex. About diyuta, the lo chashiv kulehai, a diyuta, which is just this small area, whether it's the roof, it's the top row of bricks, whatever it is that you're maintaining, lo yafe kocha kamo aliyah. You don't gain rights like that, like owning a full house on top. He says, ubekuntris, in the Rashbam, dochach bechinam lefereish binyan acher. He tried to make a different distinction between a bayit v'aliyah and the case here. He says, bayit v'aliyah, they split it. And therefore, when they split it, it was embedded in the split this way, versus over here, where he's selling it. He says, it has nothing to do with it. It has to do with what you have. In the case of Bayit Ve'Aliyah, you have a real house on top of the other guy's house. That gives you not only rights to the house, but gives you rights of ownership to rebuild the house. Over here, when you maintain it for yourself, a little top of a roof, or a diyut or a leona, that's what you get. You don't get these permanent rights to always build it, and then unless you stipulate otherwise. And that's what gives you the rights. So that's one way to explain it. The other possibility is that you do have a right to build on top. The Rabbeinu Gershom says literally that what right you bought here was to build a next level, to build another level on top. And that's what Rav Papa is saying. He didn't give this answer to explain how he would fit into Reish Lakish. Because here he's speaking about something, not only is Davar Shaloba the Olam, but something that doesn't exist at all. It'd have to be that the house falls down and a right that's in the future. And that's much further away from that case of Reish Lakish versus the right to build immediately, which is a right that has residual impact immediately. And therefore, that's why Rav Papa did not give this explanation to help him fit into Reish Lakish, because this makes it even further away from Reish Lakish. But then it would turn out that Rav Papa is the Chumrah, in a sense. Rav Papa is the giving much more than Rav Zvid. And again, most Rishonim lean against that, saying that Rav Papa is giving less than Rav Zvid over here. Whereas according to the Rabbeinu Tam, the right here is to build on top of this diyuta, which is basically the top row of bricks that sits on the roof or surrounds the roof. But the Rabbeinu Tam says he has air rights to build above there, but does have a right to weigh on it, according to Rav Papa. As Rav Zvid allows you to put pressure or weight on the building, Rav Papa allows you the air rights to build above, but not to put weight on the building. But we'll explain that more in detail at the end of the Gemara, where we'll see the Rabbeinu Tam. So now the Gemara says, Bishlam al the Rav Zvid, Hainu Diktani Zoto Meret. For Rav Zvid, I understand why Reish Lakish extrapolated from the Braita that we brought to the case over here. In the Braita we brought by the Maaser Rishon of the Levi, the answer to the problem was that the Levi gained ownership in the property. That's how we solved the problem. And Rav Zvid is saying the same thing over here. Zoto Meret, in the case where he sells the house and maintains the Diyut or Eliona, he's maintaining ownership in a portion of the house. He's not just keeping the Gag. He's maintaining excess ownership. I mean, it's not just the gag, but the ability to use zizim, or whatever you think those zizim are, that you maintain rights here that are ownership rights in this property. And that's why he compares the cases. But, El Rapapa, my zoto merit. Why is this an extrapolation of the case? The difference being that, in the case of the Maaser Rishon, you're retaining real ownership in the field in order to have that right be the case. Over here, you have future rights to do something according to Rav Papa. That is, either according to the Rashbam and the Balei Tosafot, you have the right to rebuild this in the future if it falls down. For the case of the Rabbeinu Gershom, you have a right to build another level on top of this. In either of those cases, it has nothing to do with ownership now. It's not that you own this now, that's what's giving you the right. It's simply that you've gotten yourself a right. You're buying that right in the future. Why is that an extrapolation of the din of the Braita? That doesn't make sense to be an extrapolation. And the Gemara therefore says, El Rav Papa, my zot omeret kasha. It's a difficulty for Rav Papa. And we know from early in the Masechta, the Rishbam already quoted us the Shita of the Rabbeinu Chananel and the Gonim, that when the Gemara has a kasha, it means it's a very strong question, but there are ways to get out of it. It's not like a tyufta, which means that it's a fail-safe question in which you will have no answers to it. But kasha means it's very difficult, and it'll be very hard to explain Rav Papa in this context, but there will be answers. You could find answers. For that reason, most people are going to paskin like Rav Zvid, because the Gemara leaves Rav Papa in a very difficult position based on that explanation. Therefore, the halacha will be Rav Zvid, although there are people like the Rambam who paskin both like Rav Zvid and Rav Papa, that you have both rights over here, because of the fact that it's a kasha. Kasha means that Rav Papa is not rejected completely, just means that Rav Zvid's position is stronger, but it doesn't mean that Rav Papa was rejected completely. Okay, Amarav Dimi Minardai. Haiman de Mazvin le Beta le Chabre. Person here who sells a house to his friend. Afagav dichtiv le Umka Veruma. Even though he included in the contract that you get all the depths and all the height of the house, Tzarech le Michtav le, he still has to add in this additional language of Kanani lecha mitom ara badrum rekia, that you got from the depths of the earth until the heavens. Meaning that you need this extraneous lashon. Again, that's the Rashbam who says all over the place, and here again it's obvious, that extraneous language gains you rights that you wouldn't otherwise had. The question is, what was your default status without this? What is your status with this? And then what's your status with even the excess or more extraneous language? Well, here you have three different possibilities. You have a possibility that you included no language whatsoever. Then there's a possibility that you included the language of Ruma V'umka, its depth and its height. And then there's a third possibility that you added in, Mitom Ara Adrum Rakia. So you have three different scenarios of purchasing the house in which the language in the contract reflected that. Either no language, Ruma V'umka, or Mitom Ara Adrum Rakia. What does each one of these languages add for you? My Taima. Umka V'ruma Bistama Lokani. That is because if you don't write Ruma V'umka in the contract, you wouldn't get it. That means that those aren't the things that come along with it. What are those rights? What is Ruma V'umka? That means that the rights below and the rights above. The rights below are the ability to excavate or to dig under the house. Those rights, if they're not mentioned in the contract, those are retained by the seller. That means that if the seller wants to do some lateral drilling, or he wants to do some lateral digging under your house, as long as he maintains the structural integrity of your house, he has permission to dig underneath, because he didn't sell you the land rights underneath. He sold you the rights to have your house sit on this land. He didn't sell you the land rights below the house. And the same with the rakia above. It means that if he doesn't sell you the rights to the rakia above, that the air rights above the house, he did not sell to you. That means that you maintain the rights to, first of all, the roof. That's what our Mishnah says. That if you say nothing, then the roof belongs to you, because when you sell the house, you don't necessarily sell the roof with it. So those air rights or roof rights are retained by you. That's the way that Rashbam learns it. And so therefore, if you don't mention Rumva Umka, Vistama, you're losing out on your digging rights below, your excavation rights, and you're also losing on your air rights or your roof rights above. And then, if you add on, then, Ahani Umka Varuma, the Mikne Umka Varuma, then if you add in that language, that gives you additional rights. Those rights are what we extended over here, which is that one right is that you have the right of excavation below. The second right, according to the Rishpan, the Baal Tosfot disagree with this, the Rishpan believes that the above now gives you the roof. Because you added an umka veruma, the umka gives you excavation rights, rights below. The ruma gives you rights now to the gag. So normally it would have been machara bait, lo machara gag. Over here, once you add in the word Roma, it also entitles you to the gag. Not only did you buy the house, now you also bought the gag above. Then, Bahani mitomara bad rum rakia, that adds on something else. What is that adding beyond what we had before? The miknet bor vidot, umechilot. That allows you to acquire the cisterns, whether it's in a bedrock dug into the bedrock or dug into the ground, or whether it's built out with bricks, or tunnels that go below the house. You would acquire all of those. Those don't naturally come with the house. You can look and take a peek on the Omer Aleph of tomorrow's daf. The Mishnah there says that what's not included in the sale of the house, we already bumped into this earlier in the Perek, but not only is the gag not included in the sale of the house, but neither is the bor or the dot. None of those are included in the sale of the house. Afa pi shekotav lo ruma v'umka. Even if you wrote ruma v'umka, those things don't come with the house. So the extraneous language now of mitom ara vadrum rakia, they give you additional rights now. Which is, if you didn't explain that, they'd be worthless. So the language must mean something. What does it mean? It means that you get the bor and the dot here. And the Rashbam makes the point that because the gag is usage that is similar to the house, therefore it goes along with ruma v'umka. On the other hand, the bor v'dot, as we've already noted, are a completely different utility than the house. Therefore, they're not included in Rum Kavuma, and you need Mitom Ara Ad Rum Rakia to include those items. Now, as the Rashbam points out over here, he says that the Rakia is meaningless. It's only the Tom Ara that adds anything. Ad HaRakia doesn't add anything over here, because you already gained from Rum Umka the rights to the roof and the airspace above. So then, what is the Rakia adding for you? So why does it express it this way? Because he says, otherwise you wouldn't be able to use it. The language would make no sense. What would you say? Mitom Ara Ad Ara? From the depths of the earth until the base of your house, then you would have thought that maybe that excludes the roof or the airspace above. So you have to write, Mitom Ara Ad Rom Rakia, even though the Rom Rakia is not necessary here, it doesn't gain you any extra rights. The only thing that gains you extra rights over here is the Tahom Ara. Now the Rashbam, the Shita Tov, requires that you write both languages into the contract, or seemingly requires you to write both languages into the contract, both Ruma V'umka and Mitom Ara Ad Rom Rakia. It's because of the extraneous language which is gaining the extra rights. Others suggest that if you replace Ruma V'umka with Mitom Ara Ad Rom Rakia, that would do it, because the meaning of those words is what grants you the rights, not just the extraneous nature of the words. Rashbam over here does qualify this din and say, that retained right is only true for the seller himself, but not from his children. Because we saw before that unless he specified Liu Vanai, he only gets that right for himself. And therefore the Ashram concludes that which Reish Lakish extrapolated will only be true for the seller, not for the seller's children. The other hand, the Ramban disagrees and says it's different, which is by the case of the Maaser, over there he was getting rights more than property. Even though we said Shiur, that he left behind a portion for himself, over there we discussed why it doesn't automatically pass to his children, because it's more similar to a right than it is to a land ownership. But over here, when it comes to the case of the house, where he left himself the Diyuta El Yona, over there he left himself real ownership. And real ownership can be passed to the children, and therefore the Ramban believes that this right is maintained by the mocher, by the seller, and then can be passed to his children, even if he doesn't specify li ulavanai. The Rishonim note that this machloket, or this necessity for ruma and umka, is unique to a house. Because in a field, of course, you have to get those items, because otherwise, how could you utilize the field? You need the airspace to get the rain and the sun onto the field. I need the depth to get the sustenance, nutrition for the water beneath, for the roots of the item. And therefore, this whole idea of ruma v'umka is only relevant by a house, not by a sadeh. Although the Rashba over here suggests that by a field you do get the ruma, you do get the airspace above, but the umka rights you do not get unless it was specified, because even though the roots, you have rights to have the roots go and sustain themselves below, but the excavation rights below are maintained by the seller unless stated otherwise or explicitly that they're granted to the buyer of the field. So the Balei Tosafot disagree on two fronts to the Rashbam. First of all, they say there are ways to say it without including in the word rakia. You could just simply say, mitahom ara adruma. They could have just said it that way. And then you would have had exactly what you needed. And you wouldn't have to use that extraneous lashon of rakia. So they say you must be acquiring something through the rakia. And therefore, they disagree with the ruma v'umka explanation of the Rashbam. Which is that the Rashbam said that when you include ruma v'umka, then you get the excavation rights underneath, and you get the gag that is above. And the Rashbam makes the point that because the gag is usage that is similar to the house, therefore it goes along with ruma v'umka. On the other hand, the bor v'dot, as we've already noted, are a completely different utility than the house. Therefore, they're not included in ruma v'umka, and you need mitom ara ad rum rakia to include those items. And the Balei Tosafot say that's not the case. L'chein niradari, da gag nami koi. Da afakav t'ilei uma v'umka, lokani the gag, sheesh lo makeh gvuo ayud tefachim. That if you say Uma Varumka, you get the excavation rights down below, but you do not get the rights to the roof if the walls around the roof are 10 tefachim high. But we might see the Meimar, Vahani Rum Rakia, the Miknegag. And that's what the Rum Rakia helps you to do. Not only get the Bor Vedot, but also gets you the Gag that has Ma'akeg Vod Yud Tefachim. Elo Chashas the Minkat. And it didn't bother to say it. Dochak Ri, the Kayim Perish Akuntris, the Ri went out of his way to try to explain the Rashbam's position, even though he disagreed with it. And he says, the Hani Rum Rakia, the Miknei Bor Vedot Shalagag. That to say that Rum Rakia helps you to buy the Bor Vedot that were kept on their roofs. Because they used to have Mikvaot on their roofs. They used to have water storage basins on their roof. And therefore what it means, may Tom Arad Rakia, means that you get all the Borot or Dotot that are in the ground, as well as those that are up on the roof. That's how you try to explain the Rashbam to get him out of that problem. But in the end, the Reed thinks that when you buy the house, if you buy the house without stating anything, you have no rights below the ground, and you have no rights to the roof. If you buy it with ruma v'umka, then you get rights for the excavation rights. You also get roof rights, but that's only if the roof is not significant in and of itself. If it's not a roof that has walls around it that are 10 tefachim. If it has a roof that has 10 tefachim walls around it, it's so significant that it's not included in ruma v'umka. What you will get then are the land rights below and the air rights above that area of the roof. But you will not get the roof itself. And that's why the Tahom Ara Ad Rakia gives you the rights to. Tahom Ara gives you the rights to the bor of the dot in the property, along with the excavation rights that you got from Ruma V'umka. And then the Rakia gives you the rights to the roof, even if it has walls that are around it that are 10 tefachim high. And that will be adjoined to what you got from the Ruma, which was the air rights above that, or any roof that had less than 10 tefachim walls around it, that you already got from Ruma v'Umka. Added on to that with the Rakia, or the rights to a roof that has 10 tefachim walls around it. So Gemara says, Lema Misayale. Let us say that the upcoming Mishnah, the simplest reading of the upcoming Mishnah, is supportive of Rav Dimi's position, which is, Velo et abor, velo et adot. The next Mishnah begins, and when you sell the house, you don't get the bor and the dot along with it. Even though you explicitly wrote in the contract, umka veruma, despite that fact, you're not entitled to it. So that sounds exactly like Rav Dimi, that you need tahom ara ad rikio to get you those rights. So it sounds like when you write rumba umka, you don't get, you get everything else, but you don't get the boar and the dolt. Visa gadatcha bistamakoni. If you say that without umka verumka, you would get the land rights and the air rights above, umka veruma lahane, umka and veruma should make it excess or extraneous language that you should have acquired the boar and the dolt with that. Umka verumka the mikneh boar v'dolt. If you say that bistama kani umka veruma, if you by definition or by default you get the umka veruma, then lahane umka veruma the mikneh boar v'dolt v'michilot, that the extra language or extraneous language of umka veruma should have gained you extra things. Then that would prove to you that umka veruma in of themselves don't have those rights. So what the Gemara is saying is, based on that Mishnah, it sounds like when you write umka veruma, boar v'dolt is not included. Which shows you that umka veruma only includes certain rights, but they exclude other rights. Because if you believe that without umka veruma, you would be entitled to the umka veruma, basically, then when you say umka veruma, you need to add something on, and that would be the boar v'dolt. The fact that we don't say that means that there are three stages here. There's the default, there's umka veruma, and then there's mitomara, Adrikiya Shemaima. I says, no, it's a case to lo katovle. He didn't write it. They didn't write umka veruma in the contract. Wow. The Mishnah says, afal pi shikatovlo umka veruma. What do you mean he didn't write it in there? Baha afal pi shikatovlo tani? Doesn't it say that he wrote it for him? Hachi kamar. This is what it means. Afal pi shalo katovlo kami shikatov dami lamikne umka veruma. It says, even if you don't write in the words umka veruma, that is the default status. You get umka veruma, it's as if you wrote it. So even if you don't write it, it's as if you wrote it. But if you wrote umka veruma, then that would be mikmeh v'dor v'dot umechilot. If you actually wrote it in, then you would get more. Since if you didn't write it, you would get the umka veruma anyway, then when you do write it, you get even more rights, which is, you get the rights to the bor v'dot. So, ikatav le umka veruna kani. If you write it, you'll get it. If you don't write it, you don't get it. Then it won't be approved to Rav Dimi anymore, because then there are only two stages. There's default, and then there's umka veruma. Default means you get all the rights, meaning the land rights below, the excavation rights, and the roof rights, the air rights above. Umka veruma adds on top of that that you get the bor v'dolt, and according to the Tosfot, you get the roof. According to the Rashbam, the roof went automatically on the default case before. So you see that, can't bring a proof from that if you reread the Mishnah in that manner. It's a difficult reading of the Mishnah. The Gemara wants to show that you can't say automatically that the Mishnah is a proof to position of Rav Dimi. Tashma. So let's say that this be a proof. This is from the first Mishnah in the Perek. When you sell the house, you don't get the gag when it has a wall around it that is 10 tefachim high. If you say that by default you get the umko veruma, why does it matter that the walls are 10 tefachim high? Why does that change anything over here? The way that the Rashbam reads this is that the Gemara here is continuing with what it said before, and now the Gemara believes that in the first Mishnah of the Perek, it was not written umka veruma, because it only starts mentioning the words umka verumka in the Mishnah coming up on the Samach Dalet Amud Aleph. The Mishnah at the beginning of the Perek never mentioned the words umka veruma. That means that the case in that Mishnah is a case where you clearly did not write umka veruma. And yet, when it says that you didn't write umka veruma, you still leave over the roof. Wait a minute. According to the Rashbam, if you say umka veruma, the roof goes. That's it. You get the excavation rights below and you get the roof rights above. So now over here, where you did not write umka veruma, and you're telling me that the default scenario is that you get umka veruma, then the roof rights should have gone. Why did the roof rights not go over here? And especially the way that the Balei Tosafot expressed it in the Rashbam is, over here when you get umka veruma, what you're going to get is, you're going to get the whole house, you're going to get the air rights above the roof, and you're going to say to me, though, do you retain the roof rights in between? It makes no sense. Of course you get the thing straight up once you have umka veruma. That's a proof that obviously, bestam, you don't get umka veruma, that you don't have umka veruma because the gag is left behind. The fact that the gag's left behind shows you're not getting that. The Gemara says, no, there is something. Since it has walls that are 10 tefachim high, it is significant in of itself. And since it has a significance in of itself, it can be separated away from that general principle. What the Gemara's question is, according to the Rashbam, this is the Rashbam reading it, the Shita To, is that, listen, if Umka Varuma is there, then Umka Varuma should include the excavation rights below and should also include the Gag rights above. So now, if that's the case, and you're telling me that Mistama, that when you sell without saying anything, you get the Umka and Ruma rights, how come in the first Mishnah in the Perek it says, seller maintains the roof rights? You sold Umka Varuma, Mistam, you should have also sold the roof rights. What that shows you is that Mistama, you don't get the roof rights. That also means that you shouldn't get the excavation rights. Or in essence, the default scenario is that you don't get Ruma Veumka, unless you stipulate. If you stipulate it, then you'll get the excavation rights, and then you'll get the roof rights. The Gemara wants to know, well, if that's right, what you're saying is correct, that the default scenario is that you don't get roof rights, and you don't get excavation rights, why does it matter that the roof has walls around it that are 10 tefachim high? Any roof should be left out, because you're telling me there are no air rights, there's no rights above the house. The answer is, because mishum dechashive, it's significant. If you have a roof that has less than 10 tefachim, it's batel begabe abayit, and it's sold with the house. Not because of ruma v'umka, but simply because it's a part and parcel of the house. It doesn't have separate, distinct usage, because it's not a significant space. Once you have walls that are 10 tefachim high, that's a separate entity. Then it will not be included in the sale, mistama, because you did not say ruma v'umka. Or in other words, what the Reshbam is saying is that this piece of the Gemara is a proof to Rav Dimi's position. It's undermining what the Gemara's question before. The Gemara before said, look, let the next Mishnah be a support to Rav Dimi. The simplest reading of the next Mishnah is supportive of Rav Dimi. But it says, no, you don't have to read it that way. You can read it this way and say that the default includes Ruma Vomka. The Gemara goes, if you do that, then the first Mishnah in the Perek is problematic because of Gag. Therefore, you can't read it that way. If you can't read it that way, then the Mishnah is supportive of Rav Dimi. In essence, what the Gemara is doing is bringing a proof to Rav Dimi by showing that the first Mishnah is a default case. Number two is the Gag is left over. And in a default case, the Gag is left over. That means that Ruma v'Umka are not working in a default case. And that's a proof to Rav Dimi, which says there are three stages in the sale. There's a default, there's Ruma v'Umka, and there's Mitom Ara ad Lerom Rakia. Those are three different stages that you have. And therefore, that would be proof to his position. This is premised on a number of considerations that the Rashbam has given us until now. Number one is that Ruma v'Umka include the roof. That's what the Rashbam said before. The Baal Tosafot argued on that and said the roof is not included when you say Ruma v'Umka. So therefore, that would not be a good explanation over here. And number two is the Rashbam believes that if you have air rights above and you have the house rights below, then automatically the roof has to go. You can't have it that the guy owns the house. He owns the air rights above, but he doesn't own the roof in between. That would make no sense. Based on those two positions of the Rashbam, that's the explanation that he gives to the Gemara over here, which the Baal Tosafot disagree with. By those who vote disagree on a number of items. One is that just because you have air rights above and house rights below doesn't mean you automatically get the roof. Number two is that they don't believe that Ruma v'Umka gives you the roof. And therefore they read this Gemara entirely different than the Rashbam. The Nira the Refri, the Faresh Dekoya ratio, is going back on the ratio of a Loet Agag. Can appreciate the L. It's going not the Gag like I explained before. And this is the nature of the Gemara's question here. Or, in essence, what the Gemara is saying is this should be a proof to Rav Dimi's position, which is that the previous Mishnah says that the Gag does not get sold with the bayit when the Gag has walls around it that are 10 tefachim high. And the nature of the Gemara's question is the following. If Bistama, according to those that say that automatically you get Ruma v'Umka, which means that, in general, you get the excavating rights below and the roof above, because those are included in Ruma v'Umka, if the walls are not 10 tefachim high, then if it's so easy to gain rights above, then those rights should also gain you the rights to the Gag that has walls that are 10 tefachim high. Why should there be a difference between a regular Gag and a Gag that has walls that are 10 tefachim high? According to Rav Dimi, where the Mishnah, when you say Stam, it does not include Ruma v'Umka, I can understand why the Gag that has walls that are 10 tefachim high are left out. Is because you don't really gain rights when you do a default. Ruma v'Umka you need in order to increase the rights. That means in a default scenario, you have no rights, and that's why the roof would be left over. But for you who believe that in a default scenario, you get Ruma v'Umka, and that means that you'll get a roof and you get the excavation rights below, why should there be a difference between a roof that has walls around it that are less than 10 tefachim and a roof that has walls around it that are 10 tefachim high? In either case, it should be strong enough for the default scenario to capture that Gag. The answer of the Gemara is that no, 10 tefachim chashive. That once you have walls that are 10 tefachim high, it gives the roof significance. And that would be the differentiating factor, that even though in a default scenario you get ruma v'umka, ruma there will only include the roof when it has walls that are less than tefachim. Once the roof has walls that are greater than tefachim, that gives it significance in of itself, and that's what separates it away from the house, even when you say ruma v'umka. And this is Tosafot the Shitato, who says, even when you say ruma v'umka, walls that are 10 tefachim high do not come along with it. And that's because it's significant in of itself. Amalei Ravina the Ravashi Tashma. Let's see from this situation whether we can determine whether this is supportive of Rav Dimi or not. Damar Ishlokis Zoto Merit. That the extrapolation from the Braita before is Zoto Merit. Amukher by the Chaveiro Varmarlo Amanachi Diyuta Yonashili Diyuta Yonashalo. Varmin on the Mayhil Fada. And over there we say, what is the Nafkamina retained the rights to Diyuta Yonah? That you take and have these ledges or projections come out, whether according to the Rashbam, that means you have a right to put into the airspace of the Chatzer, according to the Balei Tosafot, you have a right to put those Yizim in and rest weight on them or put something on them. That if you want to build an upper level on top of that, that you have a right to build the upper level. The Gemara wants to understand, according to Rav Papa, v'isakadatcha b'stama lokani, lamali amanat. According to the Rishbam over here, the Gemara's question is, assuming that Rav Papa's shita is that you can literally build on top, if we believe that stam, the buyer gets the umka veruma, then it makes sense what the amanat does before, in the case of Reish Lakish, amanat, that you leave out the diyuta elyona, there's a necessity to have that be left out, because of the fact that otherwise the buyer would get it. But if you say that in a stam the buyer doesn't get it, then why does the mocher need to stipulate this answer? But if we can't explain Rav Papa, then that's a question on Rav Dimi's position, because he's making Rav Papa now unexplainable in the position before Reish Lakish. Because what do you need Rav Papa to tell you that you can build on top when that is the default scenario that the mocher retains those rights? The answer that Rav Dimi gives is, no, it's not just retaining the rights. Default case where Ruman and Umka is not included, but it's additional rights that you have the right now to rebuild it if it falls down. That the Gemara questions that if you have the right to the Ruma, of course it can build on top. So it must be something in excess of that. So the Gemara answer is, that's exactly what it helps him for. That you're right, even though he would have owned the air rights irrespective of the statement, because you would have owned Ruma Vomka based on the default rights. So then what is Rav Papa adding that you have Aliyah rights on top of it? You misunderstood. Aliyah rights doesn't mean the right to build an Aliyah on top of it. Aliyah rights mean that you have the right, if it falls down, to retain that right and to build on top of it afterwards. So that's the explanation of the Rishbam, the Balei Tosafot, for Rav Papa before. This is the conclusion of the Gemara. Based on this conclusion, that's how they explained Rav Papa before. Rav Papa is right to build an aliyah on top is not literally to build something on top of it, but rather the right to put up something on top if it falls down, meaning to replace the gag or whatever you had that was a retained right of yours, you have a right to replace it. According to the Rishbam over here, based on the Rabbeinu Hananel's Girsav, Din Nafla Hadar Bani La, if the diyuta falls down, then you have a right to rebuild it. But that's not the Girsav that we have in our Gemara, which is Din Nafil Hadar Bani La. But most of Rishonim maintain the gears that we have here, which is Nafil Hadar Bani La. That it's not Inafla, if the diyuta falls off, that he has a right to rebuild the diyuta, but rather that if the house falls down and then he rebuilds the house later, that you have a right then to put up the diyuta again. And that's what Dinafil, if the house falls down, then you have a right to rebuild the item afterwards when they put the house back up. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it is that he didn't give this answer before to explain how he would fit into Reish Lakish. Because here he's speaking about something not only is davar shaloba de olam, but something that doesn't exist at all. It'd have to be that the house falls down and a right that's in the future. And that's much further away from that case of Reish Lakish versus the right to build immediately, which is a right that has residual impact immediately. And therefore, that's why Rav Papa did not give this explanation before to help him fit into Reish Lakish, because this makes it even further away from Reish Lakish. According to the Rabbeinu Tam, who says that when Rav Papa says that the right to build on top of the house literally means a right to build on top of the house, And the question of Zoto Merit means that the air rights to build on top of the house, how is that parallel to the Braita before? Because Braita before gave you a tangible ownership right. This has nothing to do with it. This has to do with Itur Lashon, telling you that you have a right to build afterwards. And therefore, according to Rabbeinu Tam, the question here on the Papa is based on our conclusion before that you don't bestam get umka veruma, then what is Rav Papa telling us over here that you're allowed to build the Aliyah on top? Of course you're allowed to build the Aliyah on top because Ruma v'umka is not the default scenario. And therefore you automatically, when you sell the house, maintain the air rights that are above. And if you have the air rights above, what's Rav Papa adding if he's saying to you, oh, if you say, I'm not, to I keep the Diyuta Elyona, that I have rights now to build on top on stilts, you add those rights irrespective of saying I'm not. The answer is that you have a right, if it falls down, to rebuild it. What do you mean you have a right to rebuild it? That doesn't mean anything either. You maintain the air rights. You're building it on stilts anyway. It has nothing to do with the house below. So what the Rabbeinu Tam says is that you have a right to force the house to be built below, even though your Aliyah is going to be standing on stilts and doesn't need the house below to be rebuilt. Ah, so then what's the purpose or why do you have a right to force the house to be rebuilt? He says for one of two reasons. Either you can demand that the house be below to stop the airflow below your house. If you just put up this upper area with stilts and there's no house below it, then all the air is going to blow underneath it. It'll cause either damage to the structure or it'll cause it to be cold in that part up above. Therefore, you can demand the house be there to block the wind from going underneath this aliyah. Or that the person living above won't be afraid that the structure will collapse and then his whole house will fall down because they'll have the house below that will give additional structural support if the outer structural support is not there. And for that reason, he can compel the house to be built or he can build it himself and then force the buy it person to pay for it and live in there until he pays for it. And then he'll move back upstairs. So Rabbeinu Tam used this last piece of the Gemara, not an additional question against the Gemara's assumption that by default, you get Ruma V'umka. And if that's the case, how do you explain Rav Papa? But rather, this is the Gemara saying, once we know, like you're saying, that we don't get Ruma V'umka in a default scenario, then why do you need the Almanat to gain you air rights if those air rights, according to the Gemara, come anyway? Because you don't get Umka V'ruma. So what is Rav Papa adding when he's saying you get air rights? You had those air rights anyway. The answer is that you have the air rights to rebuild after it falls down. What's the question? You're building an air, you have to put it up on stilts anyway. Why can't you do that? Why is it even a question? The answer is, according to Rabbeinu Tam, that that's what you can be mishabe, that you can force him to rebuild the house in order to build your house on stilts above that because of the benefits that the house provides beneath it. And that's where Rapapa's Kiddush is, that when you say Almanat, that I keep to Yuta Elyona, that is the extra right, or that's the extra that you get from that Itur HaLashon. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Samach Daled Amud Aleph.